The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, McLennan Hospital. It served Atlanta's black community between the 1940s and 80s. Now, not much is left of the building, but there are efforts to preserve its history. We'll tell you how and why it means so much. Also, from Tupac to Goody Mob, hip hop and higher learning, I'll speak with Georgia State professor Lakita Bonnet Bailey, who teaches many courses intersecting with hip hop culture, including politics and the law. It's Closer Looks Hip Hop at 50 series as we continue. Now, those conversations coming up, but first we have some other headlines to get to. Grady Health System is opening two new outpatient clinics south of I-20 this year. As Jess Mador reports, the clinics have been in the works for a while, but they are now set to open in a changed landscape for South Metro Healthcare.
It's been almost a year since East Point's Atlanta Medical Center South ER closed. Since then, there's been no full-service emergency department south of I-20 in Fulton County. The new Grady clinics will not provide emergency care, but hospital officials say they'll increase access to primary and specialty care. Services include cardiology, x-rays, labs and mammography, rehabilitation, HIV, and pharmacy services. The two new Grady clinics were planned before the loss of AMC South. The first is expected to open this summer on Cascade Road. The second is on track to open by the end of the year. And South Metro officials continue to pursue options for a new full-service ER. Jess Mador, WABE News.
Protesters plan to be at Stone Mountain Park tomorrow in response to the annual celebration of Confederate Memorial Day. As Christopher Austin reports, the memorial event is hosted by the Georgia Sons of Confederate Veterans.
In some past years, encounters between observers of Confederate Memorial Day and protesters have gotten heated, and the event was canceled in 2021 due to safety concerns. The mountain bears no ties to any Civil War battle, but close ties to the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan in Georgia. Civil rights groups, including the NAACP and the Southern Poverty Law Center, plan to host a competing event on Stone Mountain's nearby Main Street, followed by a counter-protest. This year's event comes as the Stone Mountain Board has said it will make changes in the park to make it more racially sensitive and historically accurate. Activists have complained the changes are happening too slowly. Christopher Alston, WABE News.
A bill newly introduced in Congress could help improve neighborhoods in Atlanta and other areas that struggle with vacant properties. Dormia Vance has more on the National Land Bank Network Act.
The legislation is sponsored by Republican Georgia Congressman Drew Ferguson and Dan Kildee, who's a Democrat from Michigan. They say their bill would bring attention to the problem of vacant and blighted properties, which especially affects low-income neighborhoods and communities of color in rural areas and cities. The legislation aims to support community land banks, which acquire, manage, and sell blighted properties. They say a national network of land banks would provide resources like grants and information, and they say the bill would support economic growth and development within local communities. The bill was referred to the House Committee on Financial Services earlier this week. Dormia Vance, WABE News.
The developer for Atlanta's $90 million police and firefighter training center says a soft opening for this controversial project is now scheduled for the end of next year. And Shemaine Cruz has that story.
The Atlanta Public Safety Training Center is facing 6 to 8 months of delays. That's according to John Goff, founder and managing principal at DaVinci Development. During the project's Community Stakeholder Advisory Committee meeting this week, he said the delays are partially due to the slow approval of the Land Disturbance Permit, or LDP.
DeKalb County was extraordinarily thorough in their LDP review of us. And normally this process takes maybe 4 months. and I think it took us about 11.
The project has seen scores of protests and challenges, including one earlier this month, where the zoning board in DeKalb County rejected an appeal that it argued the land disturbance permit should not have been issued. Alan Williams with the Atlanta Police Foundation told a stakeholder committee he's been inspecting the silt fencing meant to reduce erosion around the site daily and making repairs. Meanwhile, he said protesters who say they are concerned about increased flooding and pollution in the area are working to stall progress.
During the protest on March 5th, they came up and and destroyed about 2,000 feet of our erosion control. So we spent about 2 to 3 days repairing that.
Construction on the eastern side of the site is set to begin this summer, with work on the west side beginning in the fall. Shemaine Cruz, WABE News.
Well, the season is over for the Atlanta Hawks. The team lost Game 6 to Boston, 128-120 last night here in Atlanta. Celtics won the best-of-seven series, 4-2. Hawks head coach Quinn Snyder, after the game, talked about the message he gave his team.
What I told him was that I'm proud to have the opportunity to coach him. And, you know, we talked about communicating, being competitive, and being connected. And I thought we were all three of those things.
Snyder, who joined the team late in the season after the Hawks fired Nate McMillan, says he feels connected to the players and assistant coaches and is optimistic about the team's future. Let's stay with sports before we say goodbye. The Atlanta Falcons are thinking offense. At least they were last night when they selected Bijan Robinson, a running back, with the 8th overall pick. Falcons owner Arthur Blank jumped on a call to Robinson as Atlanta was making the selection.
Well, we're so darn excited, I can't tell you. I mean, we just... This is a dream for us. We've been working hard on this draft for a long time, and your name just kept coming up, and the quality of the player and the quality of the person. So we couldn't be happier that you'd be joining the Atlanta Falcons.
He's a good player, too. Meantime, three players from the University of Georgia were drafted in the first round, including Jalen Carter, 9th overall, and Broderick Jones at 14th, and Nolan Smith at 30th. So congratulations to all those who get to play football now. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. The Jim Crow era, separate but certainly not equal. Now, some of our listeners out there, I know you can share stories of seeing colored and whites-only signs. This goes back to the beginning of the 1890s. Jim Crow laws dominated the American South, and for Black Americans, these segregated mandates would separate everything. Schools, parks, libraries, drinking fountains, we've seen those signs, restrooms, buses, trains, restaurants, and hospitals. For Blacks living in southern towns and cities in the Jim Crow era, this also meant difficulty sometimes in finding close medical services. In fact, from a 1946 newspaper article in the then Atlanta Constitution revealed, Black patients were dying without getting much-needed surgeries. That article also pointed out only 44 locally available hospital beds and 25 Black physicians for the city's 100,000 Black residents. So, to address this, a Morehouse graduate by the name of Dr. Earl McClendon opened the McClendon Hospital in Atlanta's historic Hunter Hills neighborhood. Designed with assistance from his wife, the West Side Hospital served the Black community through the 1980s. No doubt, this hospital served a purpose for the community. Not much is left now of this old structure. It remained vacant and boarded up for years, and attempts to buy and preserve the property were unsuccessful. And demolition crews recently gutted the interior of the structure. But there's a movement to preserve McClendon Hospital, and there's a connection. So I'm now joined by, I'm very honored to say this, pioneering and award-winning journalist, albeit retired now, Alexis Scott. No relation, but if she was my auntie, that'd be cool. And retired journalist, publisher of the Atlanta Daily World as well. Also, Lisa Reyes, the president of the historic Hunter Hills Neighborhood Association, and David Mitchell, the executive director of the Atlanta Preservation Center. Welcome to you all. Got a whole crew.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alexis, I'm going to start with you. McClendon Hospital, when someone says that to you, what is your fondest memory there?
For me?
Yeah.
But that I was born there. But at my most recent memory was when I was about 4 or 5 years old. I had to go for stitches in my right leg. It's not a fond memory, but I was glad they were close by. Mm-hmm. But my brother and I got into a fight over a bottle of glue. And we did a tug of war, and then I fell on a glass bottle of alcohol, and it cut my leg. It put a big gash on my right leg. So I had to be rushed to the hospital. Luckily, it was right around the corner.
Wow.
Because I lived on Mosley Place then. And it was just 2 blocks away. So I got there, and Dr. McClendon was there, and he stitched my leg up back together. And it was right on my shin bone, so it was really painful. But I remember not being able to walk up the stairs for about a week, and my dad had to carry me up the steps when I got back home. So that's my last memory of McClendon Hospital, which was really good because it did save my life. I suppose I could have bled to death if I had not gotten the service.
And for our listeners, if you can, Alexis, take it further in terms of what this hospital meant to the community.
Well, it was the lifeblood of the community, particularly for birthing babies, as they used to say. Mm-hmm. It was his stock in trade for a long time because that was where we could get decent care, respectful service. And my mother had both of her children there, my older brother and me. My brother was born 3 years before me, 1946. I was born in 1949. Mm-hmm. And Dr. McClendon, in fact, lived right up the street from the hospital. He lived on the corner of what's now MLK and Chickamauga. He had a big house there, so he was a very big, important part of the community itself.
I want to stop for a moment and give him his due here, because many listeners may not even know that name, but how important he was to Atlanta, being a physician. And this is in an era with segregation, and I mention those for folks who can remember seeing the segregated signs, and Dr. McClendon was so important for the community.
That's exactly right. And it was sort of tragic the way his career ended. He was sort of put on public display with a police raid for him prescribing drugs that he should not have been prescribing, according to the police, to some of his patients. And so they shut him down that way. It was really embarrassing to him and to the community as well. We were all outraged by the way they did it.
I want to bring in David and Lisa for a moment. You heard Alexis talking about this hospital, the importance that it, the role that it played in the community. And David, there are a lot of dwellings like this, and we could have a whole nother show about Atlanta and preserving some buildings and communities, but then
we
could have a whole year. So when you hear Alexis talk about this, do you think a lot of people even know the importance of this hospital and the role it played?
I would say they know to a point. Mm-hmm. And we live in Atlanta.
Yeah,
we know we have all these things here, but it's almost kind of an assumption that someone else will do it. It'll be taken care of some other way, and a certain level of almost fear of stepping into other people's spaces and speaking for them or trying to tell those stories can at times become complicated. And we have a bunch of this stuff, but the thing about it is we don't really take stock in it because there's kind of this understanding or thought process that it's going to happen no matter what or exist. And it's only until things like this happen that we have to take that stock.
Who owned the building originally? Did Dr. McClendon own this building originally, Alexis? You might know?
I think so. Yes, he actually owned it. He built the hospital himself. I had it built.
Lisa, what do we know about what has happened over the years to this building and why we're even having this conversation. How did it get to this state?
There was actually another building that was on the corner of Sharon and Chickamauga as well. Mm-hmm. That building was demolished in 1993. I'm not sure the circumstances surrounding that, but again, the medical center was closed in 81, so it would have been vacant for quite some time. The current building has been vacant for many, many years and was recently purchased in 2021.
Who's the owner here in Georgia, in the Atlanta area? Do we know who the owner is?
Yes, we do know who the owner is. He owns several properties in Atlanta as well.
Mm-hmm. Any idea what they plan to do with this?
His plans are right now to build a house that looks worth $1 million, which is concerning to me as someone from the neighborhood because we want to ensure that our legacy residents aren't impacted by something like this.
So there are a lot of optics tied to this site here, not just in trying to preserve the history of this hospital, but now comes a whole nother set of of tentacles tied
right,
to this.
And I think that's the big thing here, is that these spaces existed before today, mm-hmm. and what they say then says the same thing now, that these people existed. And these were their experiences. And so often when you have something like a hospital or a school or things like that, those are anchors of a community. And when you lose those anchors, you're adrift.
Well, if this was bought just a few years ago, who owned it before then? I mean, I feel like we're missing something here, missing a connection. Do we know who owned it before then and how it even fell into that person's or entity's hands?
It's passed hands several times. Mm-hmm. I came to the neighborhood in 2018. Mm-hmm. It was still vacant at that time.
And this is the Hunter Hills neighborhood.
Yes.
It's a lot of history over there.
A lot. From Hank Aaron to the Scott family, mm-hmm. to the Blayton family. A lot of history.
So at this point...
And you're also getting into, you know, one thing to kind of, if you want to pierce the veil a little bit, you have to remember the real estate component of this city. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like this veiled thing that's always in the room. We have a fixation on real estate that is unparalleled. It's almost like a drug addiction of how we treat this. And so when you go into communities and spaces where you can pick up property for less money than other places, it's like anything else, it's an investment. And when do you turn that investment around?
Well, David, let me ask you, what's your response to someone listening that says, well, hey, if this has been vacant, this building has been vacant or blighted for a long time, you know, often we hear about, I just did a story on it in the news brief, you know, about how do we ensure communities can clean up blighted property? You know, if it's been vacant for so long, someone comes in to buy it, you can't really be mad at them.
I'm glad you asked that question. Yeah. Really glad you asked that question. Because one of the things you get into is you'll have a base level thing called code enforcement, mm-hmm. that has to really grow. So, for example, no one's going to call the city up and say, I don't take care of my property. Please come and cite me. Mm-hmm. Please come and make me do right.
Sure.
There has to be a level of stewardship, and there has to be a certain acknowledgement at some point in time that humanity is an investment. And these spaces represent that. And so to the point of this is that we as an organization, for example, through Hunter Hills, really got invited into this conversation. We really need to be a part of that to create that community component. Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest thing about this is to really for people to start understanding a certain level of responsibility that just because it may not be something like somewhere else, mm-hmm. all of these properties are equal in the story of telling Atlanta.
Well, storytelling, I know a little bit something about that, and
I
appreciate that, and Alexis does as well. So, Alexis, at this point, you know, what would you all like to see happen? I mean, and let me back up. Have y'all had a conversation with the owner?
We have.
Yes.
I have not.
Okay.
Lisa has been remarkable in this, and I will defer to Hunter Hills in this, but it's a very unique situation because there is the individual is the owner of the property. And there are no code restrictions. You have zoning. That's the only thing you can really use.
So what's there right now is just kind of a shell of itself, right?
Exactly.
Would you like a context, some type of marker there? Or
That is our last resort, really, because mm-hmm. we had hoped that someone might be able to step in to make an offer to the owner. He keeps telling us it's not for sale, but make him an offer. I would love for – we have about 12 billionaires in Atlanta – so if any of them are out there listening, if they would want to do that. But we would love to be able to, once it's in someone's hands, to put a historical preservation on it, to honor its history, to continue the history forward. Even in 1956, St. Paul of the Cross is mm-hmm. an African-American Catholic mm-hmm. church. They held their first service there at McClendon Hospital.
And Alexis, you and I have had conversations before. I think the last time you were on this program, we talked about the cemetery. I think it was, is it Southview? Was that the cemetery?
So
you,
yes.
You have seen so many of these historic spaces and places here in Atlanta that have either gone away or they need to be preserved. And you have, and you are, you know, you're notable and people listen to you. You carry a lot of influence. How do we stop this? You know, what needs to happen in order to do a better job of preserving some of these spaces and places, but also letting people know that they even exist? How do we keep that storytelling of this conversation? How do we keep that in knowledge?
Well, I think you're doing a great job today by highlighting the hospital and doing your work with the Atlanta history. So that's important. And I think that there should be a way to preserve these places and spaces. For instance, my dad built the house that I live in now, mm-hmm. and the house I grew up in. And I didn't even realize this until about 5 years ago when this book came out called White Flight. Mm-hmm. And it was about blockbusting, as it came to be known. And my dad built his house here. The Whatley brothers built the house. And I believe they built McClendon Hospital too, the Whatley brothers. Mm-hmm. And the neighborhood, Mosley Park Neighborhood Association, came to my father and said, please don't build your house here because we don't want you here. Mm. At the time, there were designated Black neighborhoods, and Atlanta had it was called Hunter Street. Mm-hmm. Forwards to Chapel Road going west was white, designated Black. And then it changed the name to Mosley Drive and was designated white. And my house sits between Chickamauga and Chapel Road. And when my dad wanted to build the house, they said, well, if you have to build it, just let it face Chapel Road. And he said, no, I'm going to let it face Mosley Place. So he went ahead and built it. And he said, this is an interview that someone did, this Tom West did the book called White Flight. Mm-hmm. He said that if you don't want to live here anymore, I know a bunch of veterans who are looking for places to live and new houses to move, new neighborhoods to move into, because the east side, which was where most of the Black people lived, had really gotten full, including the Oakland Cemetery, mm-hmm. which was a city cemetery. They had a designation for Blacks and a designation for Jews and a designation for regular white people. Mm. And it was really tragic to see this kind of thing happen. People not being able to live where they want to live and move where they want to move to.
And in fact, the history of Mosley Park is very, very interesting, mm-hmm. too, because that was once an all-white community. And then
absolutely.
One person of color moved in and
the rest of them moved out, according to this book that this guy wrote called White Flight.
But at this point, if we are not able to have McClendon Hospital, the structure, you know, we don't have it anymore. The owner who owns the property now has the right to do whatever he feels with it. I mean, let's be fair. Whether we like it or not, David, you're shaking your head.
Yes.
Is there a compromise here? Can you all offer instead of asking this person to sell or asking somebody to buy it, is there a compromise to have a conversation with the individual and say, hey, whatever you put here, would you also consider some type of marker?
I think that's certainly rational and arguably achievable. But the thing about it is, it goes back to this again and again and again, is the reality is when you take a property, mm-hmm. you have to know at some point in time during the purchase of said property, some history of the property. You have to know what it represents, what it signifies some way or another.
Not everybody. No, I'm just saying not everybody, you know, some folks just buy properties and just hold on to it. They don't care.
Right.
About
and that's also a challenge as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, at some point in time, you have to start thinking about your role as a citizen. And I think what historic preservation does is challenges that. It's this piece of historical interruption, because people have this concept of property rights, the concept, the idea that I own something. All these things are very intrinsic to this very unique relationship with real estate. But at some point in time, when you start thinking about international spaces, mm-hmm. people don't go to Cairo to get a meal. They go to see the pyramids. They go to see the things. They go to these places to see something that signifies culture.
Who then should be the voice or the curator or the people to make sure that when these that wherever these spaces still exist, and look, we could look to Auburn Avenue. That's a whole nother show. But and
I'd
I know
be delighted to have that show with you.
I know you would, David. I know there are a lot of organizations out there that are working, you know, to try to preserve some of these spaces and in places. But is there an entity that is almost like a gatekeeper of this to say, hey, this property here? If I think of the SCLC building, you know, it's one. There's so many. Lisa, you know, where do we begin?
Well, my thing is with I'm hoping that McClendon Hospital will be a lesson for other neighborhoods. Know your history. People moving into the neighborhood, get to know your neighbors, find out about your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That's what I did when I moved into Hunter Hills. And also, another thing I'm working on is a historic walking tour so that we can tell people mm-hmm. coming into the neighborhood or people staying at Airbnbs in the Hunter Hills, hey, take a look at our history here.
Hunter Hills, what concerns do you have about that community and its future and its identity?
My concerns are that newer residents that are coming to the area may not be interested in the history or may not think that it's important. And that's why we're having more events in the neighborhood to mm-hmm. try to bring more people out. Our legacy residents and our new residents, so that we can all get to know each other, know the history. We recently had a historical celebration of the neighborhood mm-hmm. where we had all these articles about different things that happened in our community that people, that even they had been there for a long time, didn't know about it.
As we begin to wrap up, and Alexis, I'll start with you. You talked about when you were fighting with your brother over that bottle of glue. I don't know why y'all was fighting over glue, Alexis. Y'all, what were you, 4 and 7? What y'all fighting
something
over glue
like
for?
I don't know. I have no idea, but I wanted it. He wanted it. We're pulling, and boom, I was down on the ground.
As we begin to wrap up, Alexis, and you certainly have done so much in telling Atlanta's history, what is the lesson you hope then that other communities, and you heard what Lisa had to say, about preserving these spaces and places?
I think it's important to remember your history, because if you don't, you're doomed to repeat it. And right now, the atmosphere that we have where people want to ban books and block people from educating themselves about history is not a good place to be. So we need to make sure that people know their history and that everyone knows the history, because Black Atlanta history is Atlanta history. And it's very important to preserve the spaces and places that we can and to take care of those that we can't and at least mark them.
David, I'll give you the last word here.
All right, I appreciate this. I like the fact that we say Black history, but Black history is also Atlanta history. Mm-hmm. And I think so That's often right. we create these dynamics. You can't speak of Atlanta without the inclusion of Black people's experience.
I don't think that would be wise, no.
No, but you just can't.
Or accurate.
But these buildings, yeah. if you will, serve as those kinds of, for anyone that wants to argue one's relevance, one's importance, one's significance, one's contribution, one's ability to be present, these buildings are constant affirmation of that. And the removal of them, the loss of them, is repugnant.
But
to
isn't
this,
that
this
what we say about the history of Atlanta, that it has been this place with several ethnicities, religions, races? People have come together. This was, you know, y'all call it the city too busy to hate. That's what y'all call it. I moved here in 96, so, you know.
So I'll be careful. Let's be careful.
I got a different perspective.
Sure.
But, you know, there's a lesson for a lot of communities here, you know.
That's right. You know, the Atlanta Daily World was located on Auburn Avenue from its beginning. Mm-hmm. And in 2008, the tornado took the roof off the building, mm-hmm. which was the second location of the paper. Mm-hmm. First location was down the street at 210 Auburn Avenue, but it was always rented. And the space belonged to the AME Church, Big Bethel. Mm-hmm. So they built a high rise there and put the Atlanta Daily World out. We went mm-hmm. up the street. And we went there. The tornado took the roof off our building. We could not repair it. Mm. So we sold it. But it was repurposed. But it has the historic marker still there.
Yeah.
And as a place where the Daily World was founded and also where the Daily World started newspaper syndication.
That's
a way to preserve the history. Mm-hmm. And they named it the Daily World Building.
Yeah. David, real quickly.
And I'll say Dr. McClendon, by the way, is buried at Southview Cemetery, so that's mm-hmm. another reason to go to Southview.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, about this is that these buildings and these spaces that we're talking about on Auburn Avenue, really define the backbone so much of the story we're talking.
Absolutely. Lisa, is it an easy task to try to get at least a marker if something else gets built there, this big home?
I don't care how easy or hard it is. We're going to mark it regardless. Right. And I just want to shout out to all the McClendon babies who did come out and represent and try to help make this endeavor known to everyone.
McClendon babies like Alexis Scott. I'm a Homer G. Phillips baby from St. Louis, so Alexis Scott, Lisa Reyes, David Mitchell.
Thank you
all for taking the time and giving our listeners some history. I got some emails already. Folks said they knew nothing about this.
It's a big deal you're doing this, and thank you so much. And Lisa and Hunter Hills and everybody, thank you for everything you're doing. It's more than important. It's everything.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Raise your hand if you had this on cassette blasting in your Walkman. Public Enemy, Fight the Power. For some, and it's a spirited debate, Fight the Power is one of the greatest songs of hip-hop, and of course, P.E., among the leaders of social justice messaging in hip-hop. My next guest says, I'm going to quote her here, art is political and music culture can help in the fight against injustice, if nothing else but to provide information to others about the issues of marginalized communities. Close quote. In fact, Georgia State professor Lakita Bonet Bailey has taught many college courses intersecting hip-hop culture, including politics and the law. And she's also co-director of the Center for the Advancement of Students and Alumni. Professor, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having me on today.
You know, I mentioned I came in with some Public Enemy, Fight the Power. That's a personal favorite of mine. It holds a lot. But I'm going to start with you. When you think about hip-hop at 50, what is your personal reflection here?
I think hip hop has come a long way. And just thinking about how hip hop started and where people thought it was going to go. You know, they thought it was going to be a fad. Mm-hmm. They didn't think it would make 50 years, nor be the number one music genre in the country, in the U.S. especially, but to expand globally as well. So I think over the last 50 years, hip hop has made great progress, and it has invaded every aspect of our life. And so you mentioned hip hop in the law, hip hop in politics, but there's hip hop everywhere in any aspect you can think of.
And hip hop as a movement, because that's what a lot of folks I've been talking to earlier about this. They say, yeah, hip hop is a movement so much more than music. It started out rooted in community and storytelling. You agree with that?
Yes, I do. Even if you look at the cultural and whole, it's often when we think about hip hop, most people may think about just the rapping aspect of it, but the culture involves the breaking and the DJing and the parties, as well as the graffiti art. And so, yes, this has been a movement, and we are seeing various ways in which hip hop continues to be a movement and to be a force to be reckoned with. And I think it's always so interesting because we're seeing how politicians are now utilizing and thinking about how hip hop can influence the youth. And so they're utilizing hip hop artists on their campaign trails. Mm-hmm. And so that tells you the importance and the power of the culture.
And I remember back when Diddy did Rock the Vote, and that was hugely successful, getting young folks not just registered to vote, because it's one thing to get folks registered to vote. It's another to get them to understand the reason that you want to get them registered and the power of the vote, regardless of who they want to vote for, but understanding what the power that comes with being able to exercise your right to vote.
Yes, I agree. I think Lil Jon has a perfect public service video called Turnout for What?
Where you go with you're issues. The first person to bring in some Lil Jon.
Yes, I just have to say it.
I want to go back for a moment because you talked about a song that resonated with you Tupac's Brenda's Got a Baby. What was it about this song?
So I remember Brenda's Have a Baby, and the reason it resonates with me, I think it was my first exposure to political rap, and not in the idea of that is directly talking about or explicitly talking about politics or politicians, but it's talking about a social issue in our that occurs in communities. Mm-hmm. And so it also resonates with me because this is the first song that I memorized. And so I remember writing the lyrics out, listening to the song over and over on a cassette that I recorded off the radio, you know, the two cassette players going simultaneously and listening to it just to write it down and then committing it to memory. Mm-hmm. And it was so much so that I used to sing it every night before I went to bed to myself. I just rapped the lyrics. But I think it was talking about, I mean, it dealt with many aspects of politics. I think it dealt with many aspects of society and injustice that some individuals face. But it was also about a young woman who had a hard life. And so that resonated in a number of ways because I could think about and I knew a number of Brendas. And those things that Tupac captured, you know, was something I think profound for the genre.
Telling a story. And Tupac was a storyteller. Now, folks are sending me emails about who's the best storyteller. We'll get to that toward the end of this series. But this is a story. He's telling a story about Brenda, 12 years old, and she's having a baby.
Mm-hmm.
In love with the molester who's sexing her crazy.
Yes.
Those are two powerful lines right there.
Yes. Yep, and that's what I was meaning when I was saying they're speaking to issues. And what's so significant, I think, about this is that he's speaking about issues that are often pushed under the rug, right? We rarely talk about molestation and when it happens. And often people are silenced when they are molested and do not have the option to talk about it. And we also don't talk about teenage pregnancy. And he goes on in that song to talk about how her parents, how her family put her out. Mm-hmm. Because of her situation. And so I think those are a number of various ideas that we don't really talk about. These are marginalized ideas. These are ideas that are often silenced. And he was able to bring them to the forefront to hopefully lead to more conversations around these issues.
And also to all the choices that Brenda made because of her pregnancy and so on. And, you know, folks, if you haven't heard it, even if you don't want to hear it, just look up the lyrics. And so, Professor, when we talk about now, using artists and the lyrics and higher learning, college level. You know, you do a quick Google, everybody, I think it's Lupe Fiasco is teaching up at MIT.
Yes.
You know, I think there was a school out in the West Coast that was first started teaching Tupac, you know, in college. And now everyone's got, you know, we're teaching Goody Mob, you know, and Outkast. Why has this become so important? This intersection, particularly at this level of education?
I think it's because just what I said, that hip hop gives a space to talk about issues that may not be addressed otherwise. Mm-hmm. And to go into those issues and to understand them and to dissect them and to bring them to the forefront. And like you said, you know, there are a number of artists who are teaching classes, but there are also a number of artists who are working with scholars who study hip hop that are co-teaching classes. And we have a couple in here, like in Atlanta, T.I. taught a class at Clark Atlanta University. Big Boy went into a class at Georgia Tech mm-hmm. to teach. And so there are these various ways in which, and it's important because it allows students, it gives young people an opportunity to see issues and things that they may be concerned about to be addressed. Mm-hmm. But it's also fun, right? Who doesn't want to listen to hip hop? Who doesn't want to remember the words? And we see it expand. We're thinking about it on a collegiate level. For the people just mentioned, but we think about all the programs now that have hip hop to teach younger people and how they're using hip hop in K-12.
And do you have a favorite? Because you've taught many courses, including hip hop and as well as the law, hip hop and politics. Do you have one that you take the time now to say, look, I got to tell you, Rose, the students loved it.
Yeah, I think there are two, I think, that stand out for me as my favorite. I think it's my lecture on hip hop, was the hip hop and politics class, but it's the lecture on hip hop and feminism, mm-hmm. and then the lecture on hip hop and the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think the latter one, hip hop and Black Lives Matter, is because it's relevant mm-hmm. to the students right now and what they have been experiencing within their lifetime. And so just to see how artists are expressing themselves, and it's always fun for me because I can bring in artists that students may not be aware of. And then they also bring in artists that I may not be aware of that spoke about the topic. So it is a sharing of information in the classroom.
Who'd you bring in?
I can bring in some. So I have this one slide where I talk about LL Cool J, Illegal Search. I talk about KRS-One, yep. Sound of the Police. I bring in some of those type of people to talk about how there has been this continuous issue or concern of police brutality in Black and Brown communities. And so I can show them those videos and they can put me on to some other people like Little Baby or some people that I may not be as familiar with, like some of the drill artists out of Chicago that have been talking about some of these issues as well.
Now you mentioned drill artists. And I want to switch just for a moment. Because within hip hop, there is a lot of subgenres here, and you know, we got trap.
Yes.
Thank you, Tip and Jeezy and everybody else, Gucci and all that, you know.
Yeah.
And you got the drill, and you got East Coast, West Coast, all that. Is it to a point though that you're concerned about maybe has hip hop become a little too diluted in a sense, and it's lost, or is that okay to have it? It should, you know.
I mean, I think when you're thinking about hip hop, especially historically, and a lot of people like to say, oh, well, there was a golden era of hip hop. There was this time when hip hop was so political.
Yeah.
But I will argue against that. And I would say that maybe it was a time when hip hop, the more of the political hip hop was shown on the radio. But I think it always existed. These subgenres always existed. There was always the Rapper's Delight versus the Message.
Yeah.
Right. They were party rap songs versus, you know, political or socially conscious rap songs. And I think for the younger people, for hip hop not to have so many political and socially conscious songs on the radio mm-hmm. is not a concern because most young people are streaming music. They're not listening to the radio
True.
In the way that we listen to the radio. They are picking an artist they like and putting it on their Spotify and saying, choose the station that of other artists that are similar to this artist. So they're exposed to artists that may not even have a major record deal.
Yeah.
So they have more diversity of thoughts, more diversity of music, and more diversity of artist selection.
And you remember, because we used to tape music off the radio or call a box and see if we could get a video played.
Exactly.
Ooh, Lord, I'm old. What's been the feedback in terms of these classes that you've taught? And what do you hear from your other colleagues, either at Georgia State or across the nation, and also teach hip hop and at this intersection with politics or law? What have you been hearing?
I think the students really enjoy it. It gives them an opportunity to find a different way to express themselves. And especially if you can be creative with class, like I have students do analysis of various songs for their classwork. And so they have to bring in the political concepts we learned in class, but to think about them in ways of how they are addressed within the music. And I think nationally, when you're thinking about hip hop, I think the feedback is good. And this is displayed in the fact that so many universities now are implementing hip hop courses.
Mm-hmm.
We have A.D. Carson, who was one of the first people to do his entire dissertation as a rap artist and then have that dissertation published by the University of Michigan Press as his first scholarly work as a book. And so we're seeing different ways in which the universities are now receiving and expanding on hip hop. And so UCLA just recently opened a hip hop center where they're featuring Chuck D. And so we're seeing this. We're seeing this expansion and people are embracing it. And what we know from students, even students, especially in K-12, some of their response is that they learn things better through hip hop. They can explore concepts that they wouldn't otherwise explore in their classes. And so I think the response from students is primarily good. I haven't had any bad response, and that it may be some selection. The students that come in my class, maybe students that really are interested in hip hop in some way, and it's, I mean, my classes are really diverse, and that just tells you the impact of hip hop because everyone is embracing the culture.
Now, before I let you go, because everyone that comes on this show for the series, they're going to get this question, whether they like it or not. You ready?
I think so.
Give me your top five. It could be a collective. In no particular order, I got to get your top five. And then I'm going to critique it. Just letting y'all know.
Let's see if I can give you. So, you know, we have to put Nas in there.
Gotcha.
Andre 3000 is one of mine. Kendrick Lamar. I'm really a big fan of Megan Thee Stallion now.
Really?
And I don't know if she would make the top five because her discography is not that grand, but sure. I will definitely put her in there with an honorable mention.
Okay.
Tupac, and this is again displaying my bias, right? I like lyrical content.
Gotcha.
So I'm interested in hearing what an artist saying. And so finally I round that out with Rakim.
Okay. We agree on Rakim and Pac and Nas. And I throw in, and I go back and forth, because I actually have a top 10, but I go back and forth with throwing LL in there, Chuck D,
yes.
You know, KRS-One, Lights in my top 10,
yes. You know,
Ice Cube's in my top 10. My nephew yells at me whenever I say that, but I'm like, he's like, your top 10 should be all East Coast. I'm like, nah, you folks, y'all, Cube got some snappage.
He does. He does. I would have to say I forgot Jay-Z. I mean, yeah. I can listen to and all of his albums just on, you know, on repeat. And so I like Jay-Z as well. But you don't like Kendrick?
I like Kendrick, he's not in my top 10. Don't send me an email, y'all. he might be in the top 30, but he's not in my. I'm a little old school. And I have a listener who says, what makes a great lyricist, Rose? I'm going to ask you that.
I think their ability to tell a story. And yeah. So I like the ability to tell a story and to weave in different concepts. I will say I also like T.I. I like his usage of language, yeah. His usage of words.
Tips in my top 20.
To rhyme those words. And I think it's also when you're thinking about lyricism, you know, artists that can make you laugh with a punchline or something that they say in their lyrics, or that can make you think. But also artists that can take a word and pronounce it in a different way to make it rhyme with another word they used in the previous line.
Yeah.
And so I think that's also, you know, very creative that you can think of this word and maybe drag out the end so it sounds the same as the word you used before.
And folks should know a little bit later in the summer when we have a bigger segment on feminism and hip hop, you're going to come back. We're going to spend a whole show talking about the influence of the ladies, the women in here. And that's going to be, as we say, a dope show. If you had to give someone just one album to listen to really understand, you know, get a pretty good understanding of what hip hop is all about, what is that one album?
That's difficult.
I got you.
I would probably say two albums.
Okay.
I don't know if I can choose one. Because I think there's a regional difference in sound. So I would say Outkast's ATLiens, and then Nas's I Am.
I got you. All right. We're going to bring you back. Georgia State professor Lakita Bonet Bailey has taught many college courses intersecting hip-hop culture, including with politics and the law. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting me on today.
All right. By the way, folks, here's a hint for next week's guest on Closer Looks Hip Hop at 50 series.
Tennessee.
That's all you get, Tennessee. So join us. Professor, thank you so much for taking time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And that is it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Tiffany Griffith is our supervising producer. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderwerth. Go ahead, send me your top five or top 10. I appreciate it. A reminder to let us know your thoughts on today's program or any other. You can always send me an email, rose@wabe.org. And if you missed any of today's show, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m., as well as on our podcast. So subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.